Welcome to the third part of this lecture, England's Dreaming, titled Difficulties with Too Much Rationality. Let us begin with the sage words of Ralph Waldo Emerson. A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. My focus in this section is on the notion that law must always be predictable, rational, and subject to taxonomies. That it shouldn't be in any way discretionary or based on an idea of fairness, where judges are seeking to reach what they consider to be the right result in any given factual circumstance. And in doing so, I'm going to focus, under heading A, on the theory of restitution of unjust enrichment. Now, four things can be said about restitution of unjust enrichment for present purposes. First, there can be no doubt that within its own carefully defined parameters, restitution scholarship is very fine. Secondly, however, the core cases on which much of restitution is predicated have little or nothing to say directly about restitution. Many of them focus entirely on equitable ideas. Thirdly, restitution as a principle in practice in relation to property law specifically, and equity more generally, is clearly in full-scale retreat. Fourthly, most importantly for present purposes, restitution scholarship lacks an entire dimension of jurisprudential justification for its existence. Principally, the notion of restitution on grounds of unjust enrichment lacks any philosophical concept of the, quote, unjust factor, which must be established to make out the claim. And it's this last point I would suggest, which is its principal intellectual weakness. And furthermore, I would suggest, all of the fundamental pillars on which its intellectual validity could be said to rest can be rebuffed. And I'll start with those pillars. Now, what exercises me most about the mooted principle of restitution of unjust enrichment is that its proponents are suggesting that we should do away with equity altogether. Let's just pause there and think about that. We should do away with equity altogether. Among those proposing this development are Beetson, in the use and abuse of unjust enrichment, Jaffe in the nature and scope of restitution, Burks in private law, Burroughs in an essay, we do this at common law but that in equity, and also a mention in Worthington's equity. So there is a body of scholarship out there suggesting we should get rid of equity, and that's the key idea on which I want to focus. So before we come to any discussion of the benefits of equity, I think we need to understand the shortcomings in what is being proposed to fill that gap, if anything, by its abolition. The first point here is that the organisation of unjust enrichment is based on Moses and Macfarlane. Now, the case of Moses and Macfarlane is generally taken to be a fons origo for restitution by restitution scholars, even though at no stage in the judgment does the court, particularly Lord Mansfield, use the words restitution, unjust, or enrichment. Instead, remarkably enough, the court refers exclusively to equitable concepts. Nevertheless, the case is said to create a pattern by reference to which restitution ideas can be identified. So we get this very important passage from Lord Mansfield, Chief Justice, in Moses and Macfarlane in 1760. His Lordship held, the action for money hadn't received, an equitable action to recover money which the defendant ought not in justice to keep, lies for money paid by mistake or upon a consideration which happens to fail, or for money got through imposition, express or implied, or extortion, or oppression, or an undue advantage taken of the plaintiff's situation, contrary to laws made for the protection of persons under those circumstances. In one word, the gist of this kind of action is that the defendant, upon the circumstances of the case, is obliged by the ties of natural justice and equity to refund the money. We get similar ideas in 1943 in Fabrosa against Fairbairn Lawson. From the speech of Lord Wright in the House of Lords, it's clear that any civilised system of law is bound to provide remedies for cases of what has been called unjust enrichment or unjust benefit. That is, to prevent a man from retaining the money of or some benefit derived from another, which it is against conscience that he should keep. Now, what is remarkable is that many legal historians have started to pretend that this notion of unjust enrichment has always been a part of English law, and that it can be identified in cases like Moses and Macfarlane, even though none of the language of unjust enrichment is present in that case. And even in the Fabrosa case, where there is a passing mention to unjust enrichment, nevertheless the core principle is said to be the principle of conscience, which of course is the key equitable principle. So instead of recognising that unjust enrichment can only have been part of English law at the very earliest since 1991, with the decision of the House of Lords in Lipkin, Gorman and Cartmel, or arguably it's been part of English legal scholarly culture since 1966, with the publishing of Gough and Jones on the Law of Restitution, English legal historians, for example Ibbotson, in a historical introduction to the Law of Obligations, have tried to claim that unjust enrichment has always been part of English law. It's the bedrock of restitution's taxonomy, cases like Moses McFarlane, and yet it's a decision predicated clearly on equity. It is only if you fail to read what the judge actually said in Moses and McFarlane that you can kid yourself that it has something to do with unjust enrichment at all. Claiming that this case is about restitution is like me claiming a writing credit for the Beatles' Hey Jude, on the basis that it was all written before I was born, my name isn't mentioned once, but I might claim that it's exactly the sort of song I would have written had I been there at the time. The second area for debate in relation to unjust enrichment relates to the Emperor Justinian and his notions of equity. The thirst for restitution was drawn from Roman law by Peter Burks and from the American Restatement of Restitution by Gough and Jones. Now, Professor Burks was enthusiastic in his affection for Justinian's institutes, not as to their detail necessarily, but certainly as to their form. Their form offered, and this is key to restitution scholarship, a visually neat taxonomy for private law. Thus, quote, actions, things and people in Justinian's institutes were translated by Peter Burks into consents, wrongs and unjust enrichment in the first version of his restitutionary and private law schemata. However, this overlooked the presence of equitas in Justinian's pandex, itself a close cousin of English equity, drawn, it would seem, from Aristotle ultimately. This Roman law did not operate without a pressure valve, which would permit judges to achieve equitable results. So why should English restitution survive without it? In other words, all this idea of unjust enrichment is based on an affection for Justinian, but it overlooks the fact that Justinian also needed equity. The third issue in relation to unjust enrichment is that of neatness, and the idea that rights necessarily include their remedies, which is advanced by Peter Burks. It's supposed that restitution is neater than equity, where the latter, equity, has a large historical baggage, which includes, in side pockets and under flaps, many fragmentary doctrines. However, restitution has not taken hold of the judicial imagination precisely because nobody knows what it means, and so it's just not being used in property law by the judges. One key proposition in amongst the debates about restitution was that all the rights necessarily carried with them their remedy. This, I would suggest, is a key example of the shortcomings of restitution. There's an obsession with neatness, which means we overlook the fact that many remedies under English law are discretionary. See, for example, the remedy applicable to a claim for proprietary estoppel, which differs from case to case, as we'll discuss later in this lecture. It also overlooks the fact that many rights under English law carry with them a right to more than one remedy. Hence the need, for example, for the equitable doctrine of election. Furthermore, the third version of Burks's scheme in his book Unjust Enrichment provides that the law on unjust enrichment, as it's now to be called, apparently operates in relation to any set of facts which is, quote, analogous to mistake. This version of restitution, the last before Peter Burks's untimely death, had moved from certainty into, I would suggest, metaphysics. Professor Burks himself was onto his third version of his theory before his death. Behind him lay a veritable bar fight made up of restitution scholars arguing over the number of unjust factors which could give rise to a right to unjust enrichment, the viability of the so-called quadration thesis, what exactly might be meant by analogy with mistake, whether a remedy can achieve restitution or whether restitution is itself the remedy, and other intellectual niceties. For Burks, there are about 47 unjust factors giving rise to unjust enrichment, as set out in Burks and Chambers' restitution research resource. whereas, for example, for Meyer and Zimmerman, writing in the Law Quarterly Review in 1999, there is only one unjust factor, that we should stop injustice, which I would suggest is getting close to equity. So we've got some academics arguing there is a given number of unjust factors. We've got other academics arguing there's one general unjust factor, and every other academic having a view somewhere between those two. Restitution is not neat. Rather, it's bedevilled by the uncertainties, which are all part and parcel of any properly functioning system of private law, namely the need to reach the best results on the facts of any given case. I want to consider now what I think is the retreat from restitution. It seems that there has been a retreat from unjust enrichment and a restitution of equitable thinking in recent cases. For example, in Nehru, Battery and Milestone in 2003, Lord Justice Sedley and Lord Justice Clark suggested that they considered the doctrine of change of position to be an equitable doctrine and not a restitutionary doctrine. Similarly, in National Westminster Bank and Soma in 2002, it seems that the doctrine of change of position can now be replaced by a recast, equitable doctrine of estoppel by representation. The loss of change of position to restitution thinking is equivalent to the German army losing Stalingrad. It suggested that the end of this war became inevitable as a result. My approach to restitution is set out generally in the essay on restitution in earlier editions of Equity and Trusts, and you can find it on my website. The following seem to me to be the key points. First, it's not possible to legislate in the abstract with certainty, and therefore the rigidities of the restitutionary taxonomy simply won't work, and that's an idea I'll come back to in a little while. Secondly, the recovery of an enrichment will not compensate the loss suffered by a claimant. All that happens in restitution thinking is that you subtract the enrichment from the defendant. There is no compensation for any other loss you might have suffered as a result. Thirdly, restitution is a jumble of currently existing odds and ends, which will cause more confusion by leaving ragged, unattached elements of equity behind. All of these claims already exist. Putting them in a different bag isn't going to make the world any tidier. Fourthly, the word unjust is given a purely technical meaning by Professor Burke's, an idea I'm going to come to next, which overlooks the importance of discussing and debating what we might mean by injustice in any given situation. Fifthly, restitution has nothing to say about non-pecuniary, non-proprietary claims. And fifthly, judges require flexibility to achieve fair results. That's why they won't want to be hemmed in by restitution thinking. Now, by contrast, in defence of equity, it's suggested, for example, in my Equity and Trusts in Chapter 32, that human beings are fragile, and they will always need someone to listen to their story. They will require their law to be responsive to them, and that's a theme I'm going to come back to later in this lecture. Also, the world is fundamentally chaotic, and it's equity that is required to meet that chaos. It's suggested, for example, in Professor Story's Equity Jurisprudence, written in 1886, the United States, that the concept of equity was a part of Roman law with the Pandects, and therefore it's always been part of the Western legal tradition. And further, to quote from Professor Story, that equity must have a place in every rational system of jurisprudence, if not in name, then at least in substance. As to the notion that there might be any artificiality in equity, well, it must be remembered that law functions by using fictions and artificial models to achieve desirable effects. An excellent discussion of this is by Professor Lon Fuller in his book Legal Fictions from 1967. An example of this, there is nothing innate about the trust. They don't arise naturally. You don't find them growing and lying on the ground. Rather, the trust is a made-up concept, which is useful. It has a use, the trust, and that's why it was created. The same is true of the contract. Human beings created a fiction whereby action X leads to legal rule Y, whether that's the creation of a contract or of a trust or whatever. So why is there necessarily any greater artificiality in a doctrine like equity, which achieves the socially useful goal of preventing unconscionable misuse of another person's property? Why are we drawing the line to say that equity is too fictitious, Whereas things like the contract and the trust seem to be perfectly okay. The fourth heading under which I want to consider unjust enrichment is this idea that unjust is simply a word with a purely technical meaning. My greatest difficulty with the restitution project is its determined amorality. Not immorality, amorality. And its equally determined refusal to explain what its philosophical underpinnings are. While one might expect that a theory of unjust enrichment has as its heart a moral project, because it has that word unjust in it, in truth, its goals are entirely positivist, and so not concerned with morals, nor even with Hart's rule of recognition. Burks was clear on this point in an essay in the Oxford Journal of Legal Studies in 2000. Quote, unjust here is technical, and enrichment is unjust if the circumstances are such that the law requires its recipient to make restitution. It's entirely circular. Something is unjust if you're required to make restitution. How do you know if you're supposed to make restitution? Well, if your enrichment was unjust. It's an entirely circular idea. This is deeply problematic. Not only have we arbitrarily selected one judgment by one judge, Moses and MacFarlane, as establishing the basis for this new area of law, which will eradicate, by the way, hundreds of years of authority in the courts of chancery at a stroke, but we're not even going to state the basis on which we're intending to do so. What is this philosophy? In fact, this is an entirely Nietzschean project, with Burks as its Nietzschean Superman. As Nietzsche told us in The Will to Power, it is the powerful who made the names of things into law. And among the powerful, it is the greatest artists in abstraction who created the categories. And that's exactly what's going on with restitution scholarship. It's to do with power that you are creating new categories to recast private law. And what will be lost will be the equitable possibility of looking at the individual defendant, of the individual claimant, and thinking, what does she require from the judge in any given circumstance? The restitutionary project is about dominating the discourse of private law and about subjugating it to a new model, the philosophy of which is, I would suggest, obscure, because we don't know what this word unjust is supposed to mean. What restitution thinking overlooks is that while clarity and certainty may be desirable in most legal circumstances, there will be many circumstances in which certainty is a less desirable characteristic than achieving just results. And this is why equity remains significant, and why restitution on the Burksian model will never hold sway in the way its adherents would like. Let us consider a context in which a rigid principle has proved unworkable in just such a way. These cases where the plaintiff is seeking to establish a right in the home. And that's what we'll do in the next segment of the lecture. What I want to do finally is, under a fifth heading, to consider a very problematic idea that conscience thinkers, like me, who believe in equity, are somehow fascists. There was one argument marshalled against defenders of equity, which I would suggest demonstrated an astonishing level of puerility, love of rhetoric for its own sake, and historical insensitivity. And that was the argument that those who advanced the notion of conscience in law were falling into the same trap as the authors of the Nazis' Final Solution. This argument is set out, or exposed rather, most clearly by Professor Steve Headley in the following terms, in an essay in New Perspectives on Property Obligations and Restitution. A notable recent tendency in restitution scholarship has been to accuse equity lawyers of being no better than Nazis. Now, this slightly surprising argument relies on the point that, like one famous Nazi, they sometimes appeal to conscience. It appears that Reinhard Heydrich, chief of the Gestapo and director of the Final Solution, once justified his conduct by reference to his conscience. He is said to have said, "For the fulfilment of my task, I do fundamentally that for which I answer to my conscience. I am completely indifferent whether others gabble about breaking the law." Now, in an essay in the Western Australian Law Review, Peter Burke said, "Anyone, therefore, who talks about conscience as being a foundation for private law is going to fall into exactly the same traps as Heydrich." Now, this argument has now become absurd. First, it says that conscience thinking can be jettisoned because it's capable of leading to Nazism, or allowing Nazis to sweep to power. As oddly, everyone who advocates conscience thinking and equity seems as far from being a fascist as it's possible to get. Secondly, this argument is monumentally insensitive to the memory of the Holocaust. To use the views of the author of The Final Solution to score a cheap debating point is truly appalling in my view. Now, I must admit at this point that I had found, at one time, another quotation attributed to Heydrich, in which he suggested that order and clear rules were the most important thing for any society, and therefore he seemed like a positivist. And I found it entirely by accident one afternoon reading something other than law. Now, I cannot now find it. I remember very well my joy on discovering it, recognising the perfect refutation of Burks's point, setting it aside and settling myself back with a feeling of satisfaction. Lamentably, I tidied up my study subsequently and cannot for the life of me remember I put this quotation. However, some good has come of it. I launched a search of my home from top to bottom. I reread at speed every book I suspected had so much as opened during that summer. Ditto every article and fragment I could find. Now, while doing so, I re-encountered a number of better ideas than simply meeting one quotation with another, as though such a process would prove anything, as though finding an exact counterblast would somehow solve the problem. Instead, I spent a lot of time with Hannah Arendt's work and with Zygmunt Bauman's work, two people I suspected of harbouring the quotation I sought. In so doing, I was required to think through what was so wrong with Birch's approach from a methodological standpoint, and also, more importantly, to think again about why I consider equity to be so important. The real reason why Birx's argument strikes me as being so stupid is that it suggests an ignorance of the history of National Socialism. The Nazis were painfully precise. They spent an extraordinary amount of time satisfying spurious legal niceties. The vile blood and honour laws the Nazis used were detailed documents born out of detailed debates between fine but vile minds. The legal powers for taking Jews' property from them were carefully drafted and enacted. In the 1930s, there was even a view that under international law, there was nothing wrong with these laws because they complied with German law principles. Stunning to think of it now. The, quote, final solution itself, after the first and second solutions, expulsion and concentration respectively, had been abandoned, was the result of bureaucratic skill and technological advancement. Zygmunt Bauman's book Modernity and the Holocaust explains how the Fordist production line made the Holocaust logistically possible. It was then a complete absence of morality and of any appropriate conscience which allowed Eichmann's bureaucracy under Heydrich and Himmler to put the Holocaust into operation. It was precisely an absence of thinking of the sort required by an idea of conscience which facilitated the Holocaust. Precision and clear rules were simply part of the bureaucratic machinery which made the final solution possible. Hannah Arendt is particularly powerful in her account of Eichmann's trial in Jerusalem, in talking about the absence of conscience. That word rings out in her narrative again and again like a bell. As part of the context in which the Holocaust took place, there was simply no conscience in her account. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I'll come to the idea of conscience soon enough. For present purposes, I wanted to show, I confess, by taking one of the most alarming episodes from the whole of human history, how mindless affection for rules, without a philosophically grounded morality or conscience, can give way to Arendt's notion of banal evil on an unimaginable scale. The other reason for finding Birx's argument so objectionable is that it trivialises the real impact of the Holocaust. It's the very worst sort of debating society trick. Now, I've spent far too much time of this lecture talking about restitution and talking about Nazis. I want to start talking about the alternative approach in conscience. And to do that, I'm going to begin by talking about Trust of Holmes.